From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. Vice President has been in Ukraine. The latest on the South Korean ferry and Malaysian passenger plane searches. Two Somali lawmakers assassinated in Mogadishu. Plus some World Cup news. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukraine's interim president, Oleksandr Turchynov, has ordered security forces to resume anti-terror operations in eastern Ukraine after a local politician from his own party and a second person were found dead with signs of torture. The order was made Tuesday, just hours after visiting U.S. Vice President Joe Biden departed the Ukrainian capital. Henry Ridgewell has more on Mr. Biden's visit.
Vice President Joe Biden, the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Ukraine since the crisis erupted last year, offered the country's new government financial and technological support. While the trip is seen as a largely symbolic show of support, Biden had strong words for Russia.
But now it's time for Russia to stop talking and start acting. Act on the commitments that they made. To get pro-Russian separatists to vacate buildings and checkpoints, accept amnesty, and address their grievances politically.
In eastern Ukraine, pro-Russian protesters in the regional capital Donetsk greeted Vice President Biden's visit to Kiev with skepticism. Lyudmila was among those at the barricades. The American vice president came to help the Kiev gangsters, the Kiev government, but not us, she says. In the eastern Ukrainian city of Slovyansk, funerals were held for three pro-Russian protesters shot dead Sunday at a checkpoint. The separatists blame gunmen with the Ukrainian nationalist right sector group. Kiev authorities accuse Russian special forces of staging the murders. Washington has called on Moscow to live up to commitments made in Geneva last week to put more pressure on the pro-Russian protesters to vacate state buildings. Russia denies any involvement in the protests. The White House Monday issued photographs it claims show that a Russian soldier seen in eastern Ukraine this month was also in Georgia during the Russian invasion in 2008. The photographs have not been independently verified. The allegations are part of a long history of Russian interference in the region, argues Andrew Foxall of Policy Institute, the Henry Jackson Society in London.
I think what we've seen over a number of years in eastern Ukraine is the Kremlin and the Russian government effectively trying to provoke separatist sentiments. And the recent action that we've seen in Kharkiv and Donetsk is symptomatic of that and symbolic of this wider project that the Kremlin has been trying to undertake.
Washington says it is preparing new sanctions should Russia fail to live up to the commitments made in Geneva. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And in Moscow, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev told lawmakers the country can weather the sanctions imposed on it over the situation in Ukraine.
Мы не допустим, чтобы наши граждане стали заложниками политических игр. Мир долго.
In a televised speech to the Russian parliament on Tuesday, Mr. Medvedev called sanctions absurd and said Russian citizens should not be subjected to them. Prime Minister said he is confident his government will be able to minimize the consequences of sanctions and that it will act under what he calls new conditions. He assured lawmakers that Russian industries that rely on support from other markets would get it from the government. He said Russia has no plans to ease trade with the European Union, but pointed out that thanks to cooperation with other markets, Russia can minimize its losses. Ukrainian presidential hopeful Yulia Tymoshenko held private talks with pro-Russian separatist leaders in eastern Ukraine on Tuesday in a bid to break the deadlock between them and the government in Kiev. She says more dialogue will be needed for a clash to be averted. Jamie Detmer has more from Donetsk.
Pro-Russian separatists have occupied the regional government offices in Donetsk since April the 7th. The Soviet-era music and patriotic Russian songs blaring out of speakers may give the feel of a festival, but inside, the militants are preparing in earnest for the government to try to oust them, and there is a sense here of foreboding. Ukrainian presidential hopeful Yulia Tymoshenko, a controversial former prime minister, arrived in Donetsk Tuesday to see if she could help break the deadlock and persuade the pro-Russian militants to leave the government buildings they are occupying in several eastern Ukrainian towns. She told VOA in an interview following a news conference that she's working in parallel with the government and pursuing dialogue, but that more negotiations are needed. In the meantime, she says, the government must use all the necessary means within the law to end the crisis. Tymoshenko, who also met with Donetsk business leaders, had planned to hold a news conference outside the regional government offices, but an air of menace from gathering masked militants, a scuffle, and the arrival of pro-Russian babushkas, elderly women, persuaded her aides to shift to a nearby hotel. Eastern Ukraine is not a political stronghold for the former prime minister. And although Russian President Vladimir Putin has hinted that she is his favourite among all the candidates in Ukraine's presidential election slated for next month, Tymoshenko remains unpopular here. Despite that, some political analysts suspect Tymoshenko, who's trailing badly in opinion polls, hopes to pick up votes in the East and to present herself as the only candidate who can appeal to both ethnic Ukrainians and Russians. Some pro-Ukrainian activists are angry she held talks with pro-Russian separatists. Their disappointment increased later Tuesday when news broke that a local politician and a member of Tymoshenko's own Fatherland Party was found dead, with his body showing signs of torture. The Kiev government suspects that pro-Russian militants were behind the killing. The murder has prompted Ukraine's acting president, Oleksandr Turgenev, to threaten to relaunch an anti-terrorist operation in the east of the country and forcibly evict pro-Russian separatists from the buildings they have occupied. Tymoshenko says it is important to continue to negotiate. However, negotiations don't appear to be resolving the crisis. Vladimir Makovich, speaker of the Presidium of the self-styled Donetsk People's Republic, remains adamant. He says the only way he and his men will leave peacefully is if the government in Kiev resigns. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
Each week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world.
She was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist. And she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
More bodies were brought back to shore on Tuesday evening from the sunken South Korean ferry. Total of known dead is now more than 120, but almost 200 remain somewhere inside that ferry or in the cold waters nearby. Many of them were students from a single high school in the city of Ansan. For the families, each new boat brings a powerful mix of emotions and hope for closure, but heartbreak also comes. The authorities are poised to try to lift the vessel using cranes, but with so many bodies still to be found, they're not ready yet to begin that operation. Kim Hyung-gi is the main representative of the families. He said, "We still have a lot of missing bodies. Shouldn't we find as many as possible before moving on?" The families say they have set a deadline of Thursday for the retrieval of all the bodies. Search operation continues at night, but sea conditions remain difficult, and authorities say it might be very hard to meet the family's deadline. Almost 700 divers have been working in shifts, with 200 ships assisting. A tropical cyclone in the southern Indian Ocean forced pilots to suspend the aerial search for that missing Malaysian jetliner. The Australian agency coordinating the search reported heavy seas and poor visibility on Tuesday, but 10 ships were able to continue their search for debris from the missing Boeing 777. Meanwhile, a robotic submarine has nearly completed scouring its target search area of the ocean floor. Authorities use signals from the plane's flight data recorder to determine the search area, but the batteries on the so-called black box have since run out. Malaysian authorities believe someone intentionally diverted the plane carrying 239 people as it was heading from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing back on March 8th, but they refused to rule out the possibility that the Malaysian Airlines jet experienced a major mechanical malfunction. Meantime, Malaysia's Navy chief has called the search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 the most difficult search operation imaginable.
As a nation, this tragedy has impacted Malaysia very seriously in both aspects of safety and security. Similarly, the world too has been affected by this unprecedented incident, since this is the most difficult search and rescue operation in human history.
Admiral Abdulaziz bin Haji Jaafar, speaking Tuesday at the 14th Western Pacific Naval Symposium in Qingdao, China. Massive international search and rescue efforts for any physical evidence of the plane's wreckage, now in its seventh week, has so far proved fruitless. On Saturday, Australian officials supervising the search said the underwater search for the black box recorder, based on pings possibly from the device, could be completed in the next 5 to 7 days. The current underwater search has been narrowed to a circular area with a radius of 10 kilometers around the location in which one of the four pings believed to have come from the black box recorders was detected on April 8th. The remoteness of that area where the plane crash has involved technical communications at various levels. Admiral J.R. Griggs is the chief of Australian Royal Navy.
Clearly, if you go back to the, if you can recall the slide and the scale of distances involved, from a tactical level, traditional line-of-sight communications was clearly not an option. And there was a heavy reliance on satellite communications.
Vice Admiral Ding Yiping, Deputy Chief of the Chinese Navy, said that despite massive search operations carried out by Chinese fleets in the southern Indian Ocean, their efforts have provided very few results. Reuters is reporting that China has received criticism from U.S. officials over its search and rescue efforts for that lost aircraft. This year's Western Pacific Naval Symposium has resulted in agreement between participating countries on a maritime communications deal meant to keep unexpected encounters from escalating into collisions. More than 20 countries with strategic interest in the Western Pacific region unanimously agreed to the framework, including China, Japan, the Philippines, and Malaysia. Also in the news, two Somali lawmakers have been assassinated. It happened in Mogadishu, the capital, within 24 hours of each other in attacks claimed by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the latest killings underscore the security challenges facing the Somali government.
Somali officials say unidentified gunmen shot and killed Parliament member Abdiaziz Isak Mursal as he was leaving his home in the capital early Tuesday. A day earlier, another MP, Isak Mohammed, was killed by a bomb hidden in his car. The explosion left another lawmaker seriously wounded. The militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for both attacks. Somali Prime Minister Abdulwali Sheikh Ahmed condemned Tuesday's killing and said such violence only strengthens Somalia's resolve to defeat terrorism. A spokesman for the Prime Minister, Ridwan Haji, praised the work of the two lawmakers.
Both MPs were committed to help the country. They were really tirelessly supporting local communities, and they wanted to, see Somalia in a peaceful way.
Al-Shabaab fighters have launched sporadic but devastating attacks against the government in Mogadishu and against international agencies working in the capital. The Islamist group, which used to control huge swathes of Mogadishu, has been under pressure in recent weeks as the African Union peacekeeping force, known as AMISOM, has reclaimed at least 10 towns previously controlled by the militants. Haji said the security situation in the country has been improving despite the recent attacks and that the government will find those responsible.
It is a concern, and the government is doing all its efforts to investigate and protect members of parliament or other citizens in the country.
AMISOM has also condemned the attacks, saying on Twitter Tuesday that the force will work with Somali security forces to ensure the perpetrators are brought to justice. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Uganda's military says troops have captured a commander of the Lord's Resistance Army and freed 10 people who were held captive by that rebel group. Military spokesman said African troops hunting the LRA seized Charles Okello in the Central African Republic. Spokesman said most of those rescued were children. LRA notorious for attacking and looting villages and for forced recruitment of child soldiers. The UN Children's Fund warns that nearly 250,000 children in South Sudan will suffer from acute malnutrition by the end of the year, and tens of thousands could die if nothing's done to help them. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bourguereau tells VOA more than 3.7 million people in South Sudan are at high risk of not getting enough to eat. Among them, he says, are 740,000 children under the age of five.
This means that if nothing is done to increase the to scale up the action against malnutrition, that means that 50,000 children under five could die unless they benefit from treatment. But the violences are really worsening the situation in this regard.
UNICEF staff report many people are resorting to eating wild foods. They warn the continuing conflict between the government and the rebels, forcing people to flee their homes as well. If the violence persists, it notes farmers might miss the planting season, which would increase malnutrition for children to heights never seen before. Bourguereau says UNICEF's immediate goal is to treat more than 150,000 severely malnourished children, a treatment that could save many lives.
We provide them treatment. We have several rapid response teams to reach the children. You know, there is a question of access. We bring them therapeutic food, micronutrient supplements, medicines, water purification sachet, and other things. The fight against malnutrition remains the priority in South Sudan.
Bourguereau says UNICEF has only received $4.6 million of its $38 million appeal.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.
The Beatles.
The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Listen to Today in History, weekdays on the Voice of America, following International Edition.
And it will be coming up in just a few moments with Dave DeForest. U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a ban by the state of Michigan on the use of race as a factor in considering applicants for state colleges and universities. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on what the high court ruling might mean for the future of affirmative action admissions policies.
By a vote of 6-2, the Supreme Court upheld the right of Michigan voters to prohibit public colleges and universities from taking race into account in their admissions decisions. Michigan voters approved an amendment to their state constitution in 2006, barring race considerations as a factor in student admissions. Affirmative action programs have long sought to help racial and ethnic minorities compete and gain acceptance to U.S. colleges and universities. But over the decades, they've also been the subject of fierce political debate. Vanderbilt University law professor Susanna Sherry says the initial legal fallout from the decision may be limited, since the high court was not focused on whether racial preferences may be valid, but on the right of voters to have their voices heard on the issue.
What the court held is that the voters of Michigan are allowed to decide whether they want affirmative action or not. And that's really not a ruling on affirmative action. It's a case about whether affirmative action is required. And the answer is no, it's not required. People can decide, the people of Michigan can decide not to engage in it.
The decision drew a sharp dissent from one of the two Supreme Court justices in the minority on the case, Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She said judges should confront the racial inequality that exists in the United States and not just sit back and wish it away. The American Civil Liberties Union issued a statement criticizing the Supreme Court ruling, saying the Michigan law unfairly keeps students from asking universities to consider race as one factor in admissions. But a black conservative group known as Project 21 said the decision moves the country closer to the colorblind principles advocated by the late civil rights leader Martin Luther King, Jr. California and Washington State have voter-approved laws already banning affirmative action in education admissions. And a few other states have also adopted laws or executive orders barring race as a consideration. B.C. Okuba Dejo is an attorney in Maryland who represents colleges and universities in civil rights cases involving affirmative action. She predicts a limited legal impact from the Supreme Court decision.
It's likely that this action by the Supreme Court will bolster other groups that continue to file similar suits. It's not representing a step forward with regard to the use of race, but it, taken in context, I think that any negative effects on diversity and the use of race on campus has already occurred in the states where voters have spoken at the polls.
Vanderbilt expert Susanna Sherry says court decisions over the years have chipped away at the scope of affirmative action programs, and she expects continued scrutiny at the state and federal levels in the years to come.
The constitutionality of affirmative action is much more precarious than it was 30 years ago. And I would not be surprised if the next time the court focuses on affirmative action, I wouldn't be surprised if it strikes them down.
Supporters of affirmative action programs note enrollment among African American and Hispanic students has dropped at the University of Michigan since the ban took effect. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier. World Cup trophy has returned to Brazil to begin a national tour after traveling to 89 countries and covering more than 150,000 kilometers. The countrywide visit will start the same way as the international tour did in Rio de Janeiro, which will host the final at the legendary Maracanã Stadium on July 13. It will go through all the Brazilian state capitals, ending in Sao Paulo on May 29. On its base, the trophy has the names of the countries which have won the coveted prize since 1974, when the new World Cup was introduced after Brazil claimed the old trophy for the last time in 1970. The late last captain to lift up that old trophy was Brazil's Carlos Alberto Torres, was given the task of taking care of the trophy after its arrival. Torres claims that he was the first captain ever to kiss a trophy, told how he and the 1974 World Cup winning captain Franz Beckenbauer joke about that World Cup trophy, saying he made sure Brazil won in 1970 so the West German captain could have the opportunity to lift the new trophy. Trophy will be in Rio de Janeiro until April 25th, it says here, before it heads off to Porto Alegre. And how about this? Recording artist Aloe Black and the U.S. X Factor finalist David Corey have teamed up to provide the theme song for the 2014 Games. In preparation for all of that, they recently sang it in Los Angeles. There are 24 different versions of the song in total. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the Internet at voanews.com. And the latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On April 23rd, 1616, William Shakespeare died at the age of 52. Shakespeare is considered by many to have been the greatest writer in the English language. On this date in 1778, American Revolutionary War hero John Paul Jones, along with volunteers from his warship Ranger, landed at Whitehaven, England, setting one ship afire. It would be the only American raid on English soil during the U.S. War for Independence. In 1858, German physicist Max Planck was born. Planck developed the quantum theory that provides an explanation for the movement of particles within atoms. In 1928, American child actress and future ambassador Shirley Temple was born. Temple starred in more than 40 movies. She served four presidents in several diplomatic posts, including ambassador to Ghana, Czechoslovakia, and the United Nations. In 1940, more than 200 people died in the Rhythm nightclub fire in Natchez, Mississippi. In 1942, Germany launched the first in a series of raids on English cities following British air attacks on the ancient German city of Lübeck during World War II. The so-called Baedeker raids killed more than 1,600 people and injured hundreds more. In 1949, the Chinese Red Army conquered the city of Nanjing during the Communist Revolution. That victory ended the Republic of China's rule on the mainland. On this day in 1975, in a speech at Tulane University, President Gerald Ford acknowledged the end of America's involvement in Vietnam. A week later, North Vietnamese forces captured Saigon, unifying the country under communist rule. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recent U.S.-Morocco strategic dialogue, both countries expressed their commitment to a partnership to advance a stable, democratic, and prosperous Maghreb, Africa, and Middle East. Security is one of the most fundamental obligations that a government owes its citizens. Here, the United States and Morocco stand together. For a decade, the U.S. has participated in joint military exercises with Morocco. These exercises are being expanded to include other countries from Africa, Europe, and Canada. On the economic front, Morocco is one of the fewer than 20 countries in the world and the only country on the African continent where the United States has a free trade agreement. We need to build on the strength of that investment, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Morocco's incredible potential for growth and its growing role as a vital gateway to the African continent make it even more important for the United States to grow the relationship. Morocco is already among the top African countries investing in African nations. Indeed, Morocco signed 18 different agreements with Mali earlier this year in areas from microfinance to infrastructure. Morocco is driving both greater security and greater prosperity in the Maghreb. At home, Morocco has made it a priority to promote entrepreneurship. I firmly believe, said Mr. Kerry, that the places where citizens have the freedom to dream up a new idea and take that idea and put it into reality, those are the places where people can be their own boss and where they're free to fail. Those are the societies that are the most successful. They're the societies that are the most cohesive, and those are the places that are the most peaceful, tranquil, and satisfied. The U.S. Agency for International Development is focused on supporting this kind of pursuit of prosperity in Morocco. USAID is working in three areas: developing the workforce, supporting more responsive government, and improving education in those first, most critical years. The United States and Morocco share a broad set of values that will provide the foundation for even wider cooperation within the strategic dialogue in the years ahead.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.